Hey everyone, it's Jeanette
and Kim,
producers here at The Bitchery of History. As we close out season three, we want to hear from you, our listeners, and give you something in return. So, from now until the end of May, everyone who leaves us a review will be qualified for a giveaway.
What? Amazing. So you might have seen on our Insta or on the website store that we have brand new Bitches Get Stuff Done stickers, which are amazing. So if you send us a screenshot of your review, we'll send you a sticker in return for free.
For free.
What?
You can DM us your screenshot on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook, or you can email us directly at umpboh@gmail.com.
And this giveaway only lasts until May 31st, so hurry and tell us your thoughts.
Yeah, be our friend, get a sticker, and remember,
bitches get stuff done.
Hello, everybody.
Hi, friends.
And welcome to
The Bitchery of History.
The last one of season three.
Whoa.
My name's Max.
I'm Allison.
And this week, I'm talking to you about Frida Kahlo.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah. I will be sharing the story of Pearl S. Buck.
First of all, before we get started, let's just comment real quick on the fact that we are finishing a third season.
Yes, 174 women.
174 women.
And more stories are showing up every day.
Oh my God. That's, I think, one of the wild things about this is that for all the women we've done, still people come up to this and be like, have you heard of this woman? Have you heard of this one?
And no, and it's sometimes like, I haven't. No. And it's amazing. It's almost like we're half the population.
Exactly. Are you ready?
I am ready.
For Frida Kahlo, one of the most influential artists of our lifetime.
Yes.
Now, of course, just like every other amazing, influential person that everyone seems to know about.
Right.
There's a lot I didn't know about Frida.
I'm excited to learn.
Now, she's born Magdalena Carmen Frida Kahlo y Calderon on July 9th, 1907, in a village on the outskirts of Mexico City. Now, her father, Guillermo, who she ends up being pretty close to, was a photographer, originally from Germany, and her mother was actually mostly Native American.
Oh.
They had three other daughters as well, Matilda, Adriana, and Christina. Now, she contracts polio when she's 6 years old, which leaves her bedridden and crippled in her left leg for a pretty long time. And when she has polio, this is when her and her father get pretty close. He teaches her literature, nature, philosophy, yet another woman we find where her father is helping to lead her in a good direction, and encourages her to actually play sports in order to regain her strength. And she actually helps him with his photography, thus planting the seeds of the future artist.
Gotcha.
Now, while the rest of her sisters go off to a convent, Frida was educated in a German school per her father's wishes.
Oh, wow.
And she didn't last very long. She actually gets expelled from this school pretty early on for disobedience and is sent instead to a vocational teacher's school. Now, in 1922, she's 15 years old. She's accepted into the elite National Preparatory School, which had only recently begun accepting women. And it's here where she studies natural sciences with the hope of becoming a doctor. Now, she starts working while she's there under the artist Fernando Fernandez in order to help her family to earn a little bit of money. She works with him as an engraving apprentice. Now, while there, she becomes deeply interested in Mexico's history and Mexican nationalism. Mm. And she and nine of her classmates form a group called the Cachuchas. And many of this group actually goes on to become leading figures in the Mexican intellectual elites.
Wow.
They're rebellious against absolutely everything conservative. This is a really big moment. 1925, she's 18 years old. She gets into a pretty horrible bus accident, a crash, that actually almost kills her. It leaves her with multiple spinal fractures, fractures to collarbone and in her ribs, a shattered pelvis, a broken foot, and a dislocated shoulder. I mean, talk about just completely being mangled. She begins to focus on painting while she's recovering in this full body cast for 3 months. And they actually rig her bed so that they're able to hang an easel above her. And they put a mirror above her bed as well so that she can see herself while she's painting, which is, I believe, one of the reasons why she does so many self-portraits, because she's seeing herself doing this. And she says that this isolating recovery made her desire, quote, to begin again, painting things just as I saw them with my eyes and nothing more. Mm. The accident actually caused her, ended up causing her pain for her entire life.
Yeah.
Her friend Andres Genesrosa said that Frida, quote, lived dying.
Wow.
Now
that's
she,
intense.
I mean, seriously, I mean, it's truly, when you look at Frida's art for the rest of her life, you see where it comes from. Now she rejoins her friends in 1927, who are all now in university. She joins the Mexican Communist Party, and through her participation, meets many political activists and artists, including, in 1928, the artist Diego Rivera, one of Mexico's most successful artists and one of the most famous artists to this day. She asks him to take a look at her paintings to judge if she could make a career out of being an artist. And he said, after looking at her early paintings, quote, it was obvious to me that this girl was an authentic artist right from the beginning. They started a relationship, despite there being a 20-year difference, and they get married in the town hall on August 21st, 1929, the day after my birthday, many years before I was born. Her mother actually did not approve of the marriage. She said it was, quote, a marriage between an elephant and a dove.
Whoa.
But her father was like,
I just, quick interjection, if I may.
Of like, course you can.
She lives dying, an elephant marrying a dove. I don't know if, I mean, are these all originally said in English, or are people speaking Spanish just like so poetic?
Well, it is a romance language.
Like, I feel like I missed out.
I feel like Italian, French, Spanish, all these romance languages are very poetic, and they've got histories behind them too that are very like romantic. And
English is boring.
It's boring. It's also very, it's a very, very precise language, English is. And so I feel like a lot of other languages have to find creative ways to say things.
Yeah. Anyway, moving on.
Her father did support the marriage because Diego was very successful and wealthy. And he was like, he was going to be able to support her. Exactly. And also she had a lot of very expensive medical bills.
Right.
And Diego was going to be able to cover them. Now, they move to a more rural part of Mexico where Diego he gets commissioned to paint murals. And while living there, Frida becomes increasingly interested in Mexican identity and history. Her paintings begin to show more inspiration from Mexican folk art. Mm. She begins combining elements from pre-Columbian and colonial periods of Mexican history. And it goes so far as that even the clothes that she wears, the ways that she presents her own self to the world.
Yeah.
She begins wearing traditional indigenous Mexican peasant clothing to emphasize her ancestry. This includes long, colorful skirts, elaborate headdresses, and just tons of beautiful jewelry. And comes to represent this, like, authentic Mexican identity in post-revolutionary Mexico. So she's trying to combine the two. Not only did this allow her to express her feminist and anti-colonialist ideas, but a lot of people believe that this is also that she could cover up what she didn't like about her body as well, because of all of the injuries and all the process that she'd had to go to. Now, at 23, they moved to San Francisco, her and Diego. This is 1930, where he is painting more murals for the Luncheon Club of the San Francisco Stock Exchange, the California School of Fine Arts. Frida becomes introduced to many American artists like Nicholas Murray, who she actually begins a love affair with. You'll find a lot that between Frida and Diego, they both have a lot of love affairs. Exactly.
They're artists.
And they fight and they go away from each other and then they come back and they're in love. And then
it's
they
why
fight,
there's a movie made about her life.
It is such a good movie with Selma Hayek. So good. It's on Netflix. So good. Now, they spend 6 months in San Francisco, and Frida experienced a lot of growth in her paintings at this time. Mm. She makes a painting called Frida and Diego Rivera, which is actually a double portrait, one of her few double portraits. She makes this other one named The Portrait of Luther Burbank, which depicts Luther Burbank, who's a horticulturalist, as a hybrid between a plant and a human. And she participates in her first exhibition where this painting, the double portrait of her and Diego, mm-hmm. was included in the 6th annual exhibition of the San Francisco Society of Women Artists in the Palace of the Legion of Honor.
Wow.
And we're going to post a lot of these paintings to the Facebook yes. and to the Instagram as well. Now, in April of 1932, they go to Detroit where Diego again had been commissioned to paint murals for the Detroit Institute of Fine Arts. And Frida was becoming more and more comfortable by the limelight. And when she gets to Detroit, she's quoted as saying, "Oh, I'm the greater artist of us. I'm the better artist between me and Diego." She actually struggles quite a lot in Detroit.
Yeah.
Because she sees the difference in American capitalism, and she really, really does not like it. She writes to a friend, quote, "Since I have seen thousands of people in the most terrible misery without anything to eat and with no place to sleep, that is what has most impressed me here. It is terrifying to see the rich having parties day and night while thousands and thousands of people are dying of hunger."
Woof. She's not wrong.
She's not wrong at all. So her paintings begin placing an emphasis on themes of terror, suffering, wounds, and pain.
Hmm.
Now, this is a side note from Jeanette. She says, "Holy shit, listen to this. She never had an exhibition of her own in Detroit, but she gave an interview to the Detroit News about her art, and they titled the article, quote, 'Wife of the Master Mural Painter Gleefully Dabbles in Works of Art.'"
No. No.
Let me say that again.
No.
"Wife of the Master Mural Painter Gleefully Dabbles in Works of Art."
There's so many great hollerbacks on Twitter. I don't know what you call them. Of people like clapbacks. Thank you. Hollerback. That's totally
hollerback
different thing.
Gwen Stefani.
Totally different thing. Because newspapers still do that.
Yes, they absolutely do.
And I love the ones that are like, "Hey, you misspelled 3-time Olympian wins 4th gold medal." Thanks, like from the right. From the athlete.
Or some of my favorite are like the merit when George and Amal Clooney, and it's
yes.
like famous actor husband of influential human rights lawyer wins.
I love when they turn it
trophy.
On their head. Yeah, but then I saw one too, like I think it's the Washington Post, I'm pretty uh-huh. sure, doing some article on the Big Sick uh-huh. and Kumail Nanjiani tweeted back
too.
Like, "Hey, do you mind adding my wife's name? Because she wrote the script and is the inspiration for the whole story.
Yeah.
Thanks. Bye." Like, how do you...
And they responded. They were like, "We're so sorry." And they changed the art. They
well,
changed
thank
the title
God.
Right there. Yeah.
Thank God. But come
exactly.
on.
Yeah.
Anyway.
He shouldn't have had to change it in the first
right.
place or call
right.
him out on it in the first place. Now, Diego gets commissioned to paint a mural for Nelson D. Rockefeller.
Casual.
And in New York City, and he includes
husband of amazing painter pitifully commissioned by Nelson Rockefeller.
But he includes a portrait of Vladimir Lenin in the mural.
Whoops.
And refuses to change it.
Oh no.
And so Rockefeller fires him. And they move back to Mexico in 1933.
Yeah, duh.
Right.
Whoops.
And I'm assuming they just painted over it right away. Now, the couple moves into a wealthy neighborhood.
Why is neighborhood. There a tree? I don't know.
Where did that tree come from? That's not usually in Diego's work. That doesn't even look like his painting.
That's so funny.
So they move into this wealthy neighborhood in Mexico City.
Yeah.
And they call their new residence La Casa Azul, which becomes an important meeting place for Ooh. Artists and political activists in
Love
Mexico.
It.
She actually ends up creating no new paintings in 1934. There's only two in 1935 because she has a whole slew of health issues during this time. And also her and Diego are going through a whole slew of issues themselves as well.
Fair.
He really wanted to go back to America to paint more murals and to explore more. And she absolutely hated America for all the reasons I talked about with Detroit. And so he begins an affair with her sister.
Oh.
Christina.
Oh.
Frida moves out into an apartment by herself in Mexico City and starts an affair of her own with an artist named Isamu Noguchi, another American artist, actually.
Right.
It takes a while. It takes about a year for them to reconcile in 1935. And Frida actually moves back in and she reconciles with her sister as well.
Okay.
But also, if my husband did something with my brother, done. We're gone. Then again, my brother's 6. So
I was
going to
say, like,
strange.
There's a...
Let's pretend I have a hypothetical 20-something-year-old brother.
I think I don't know, like, affairs, not great. Yeah, if somebody, like, tried to be, oh, you have a younger sister?
Right.
Oh, cool.
Behind her back, too, she didn't, like, she had to find out about the affair as well. Yeah.
No.
She makes her first significant sale in 1938. She sells four paintings for $200 each to Edward G. Robinson, who's a famous film star and art collector here in Hollywood at the time. During that same year, she's visited by André Breton, who's the famous French surrealist. And was impressed by Kahlo, he described her work as, quote, a ribbon around a bomb. He wrote to his friend and art dealer, Julian Levy, who arranges for her first solo art exhibition in Manhattan. The exhibition is attended by artists such as Georgia O'Keeffe. And although she receives positive feedback from critics, the reviews were also quite condescending. Again, they called her Little Frida and said her paintings had, quote, the playfully bloody fancy of an unsentimental child. Despite it being the Great Depression.
No, I've seen paintings that are like that where I'm like, is this art? I don't know. I could do that. But I've also seen Frida's paintings and that is not the situation.
No. Oh, no. And like that's marked by the fact that even though it was the Great Depression, she sold 25 paintings from this exhibit.
Yeah.
Exactly. That same year, 1939, the Louvre even purchases one of Frida's paintings. It's called The Frame, makes her the first Mexican artist to be featured in their collection.
Whoa, that's cool.
She returns to Mexico City in 1939. She and Diego get a divorce. The wording on the page is that it's for legal convenience. Although they remain friends, and she actually continues to manage his finances and all of his correspondence as well.
But is that because they're friends, or is that because he's a man?
You know,
he's a mess.
That's a very good question.
No offense, men, but sometimes you're a bit of a mess.
I mean, I'll take credit for that. She goes through this big period. She starts painting paintings that are bigger, that are easier to sell, because now that she's no longer married to Diego, she wants to make more of her own work.
Right.
Wants to support herself a little bit more. But by the mid-1940s, 1945 in particular, she could no longer sit or stand continuously because of the pain that she was in. And she actually travels to New York for an operation to fuse a steel support to her spine in order to straighten it.
Oh.
But the operation failed because Frida wouldn't give herself the time to properly rest and to recover.
I feel you, Frida. I feel you. I have been there.
And it's in this time where she creates a lot of her most famous artwork having to deal with her own pain. So there's one where she's basically in this cast and there's nails all over her body. There's one called The Wounded Deer where it's a deer's body, her head, and there's arrows coming out of it and blood coming out of the arrows all over it. She spends most of the year 1950 in a hospital having surgeries. Between all of this time, 1940s and 50s, she ends up wearing over 22 different braces, back braces, in order to support herself and to try and recover.
Yeah.
And she ends up, because she's so immobilized during this time, she ends up dedicating a lot of her time to various political causes. She rejoins the Mexican Communist Party in 1948 in order to campaign for peace. And she wasn't sure if she was able to portray her political convictions in painting, saying, quote, until now, I have managed simply an honest expression of my own self. But I must struggle with all my strength to ensure that the little positive my health allows me to do also benefits the revolution. The only real reason to live.
Wow.
Photographer Lola Alvarez Bravo, recognizing that Frida probably didn't have much time left to live, stages Frida's first solo exhibition in Mexico in April of 1953. Her doctors forbade her from getting out of bed, so she had her bed moved into the gallery.
I mean, of course.
She was stretchered into the exhibit. She stayed in bed for the entire duration of the party. The exhibit was a cultural event for Mexico and received mainstream press literally all around the world.
That's amazing.
She continued painting through 1954. Her last paintings include paintings such as Marxism Will Give Health to the Sick, Frida and Stalin, and Viva la Vida, quote, a still life. And she actually seemed to anticipate her death, because at this time she's mostly drawing skeletons and angels in her personal diary. And the last drawing she ever made in her diary is of a black angel, which many people believe to be the angel of death. And the last words she wrote along with that were, I joyfully await the exit, and I hope never to return.
Whoa.
I mean, jeezum crow, right?
That's intense.
Frida was found dead in her bed on July 12th, 1954, at the age of 47.
Ugh.
The official cause of death was a pulmonary embolism. Mm. However, many people believe that she actually committed suicide because she had taken 11 painkillers before she'd gone to bed and had given Diego a wedding anniversary present on that day, a full month before their anniversary.
Ooh, yeah.
Diego said that Frida's death was, quote, the most tragic day of his life and died 3 years later in 1957. Of her 143 paintings, 55 of them were self-portraits.
Wow.
She actually didn't sell many paintings in her lifetime and actually only had the one solo exhibition in Mexico in 1953. Her reputation as a great artist, like many great artists, to be honest, didn't really fully develop until after she died.
Right.
Because during her lifetime, she was mainly considered to be Diego Rivera's eccentric wife. And then in the 1970s, she actually gained more recognition during the feminist, the resurgence of the different feminist movements. The Tate Modern, which is a famous gallery in London, considers Kahlo to be, quote, one of the most significant artists of the 20th century.
Yeah.
And her artists sell, her paintings, excuse me, sell for millions of dollars. For example, in 2006, her self-portrait titled Roots sold for $5.62 million at an auction in New York, which set the record as the most expensive Latin American work ever purchased at auction and makes Frida one of the highest selling women in art to this day.
That's incredible.
So that's Frida Kahlo.
Incredible.
Oh, watch that movie. It is simply astounding.
Well, to go to a different type of art,
uh-huh.
I'm going to be talking about Pearl S. Buck.
Okay.
She was suggested to us by Lily Mercer.
Hey, Lily.
Thanks, Lily. And remember, if you have suggestions of women that you love that you want us to cover, or even just women, contemporary women that you know of that you want us to interview, please reach out.
We've already had a couple.
Love suggestions. Mm-hmm. I love suggestions, especially when it's people that I don't know or know only vaguely. It's like, I mean, research is like my favorite thing, you know, one of them. And so getting to like dive in and delve into a story.
You
and
know
just,
what my favorite is when we've had this before where it's like we have listeners in, we had a listener in New Zealand who said, hey, have you heard of this woman? She's a local hero here in New Zealand. And I had never, and none of my research had ever come across her because unless you're like there almost, Google's not going to serve you certain things.
Exactly. Mm. So it's phenomenal.
All right. Tell me about Pearl.
So Pearl Seidenstricker was born in Hillsboro, West Virginia on June 26th, 1892.
Okay.
Her parents were Southern Presbyterian missionaries, and she was the fifth of seven children. Now, they had traveled to China shortly after their wedding in 1880, Caroline and Absalom, her parents.
Mm-hmm.
But they returned to America very briefly to have Pearl. But when she was 5 months old, the family actually returned to China. And in 1896, they settled in Xinjiang, which is near Nanking.
Okay.
So Pearl later wrote in her memoir that she lived in several worlds. One, a, quote, small, white, clean Presbyterian world of my parents, end quote. And the other was, quote, big, loving, merry, not too clean Chinese world, end quote. She was tutored in English by her mother, the local dialect of Chinese and classical Chinese from a tutor. Now, this is 1896, like 1900. China wasn't necessarily the best at this time, especially in the countryside, and especially if you were a young Chinese girl. Side note, totally random, but I just was hearing on the radio the other day on NPR that because of the one child law for so long, and they didn't really mention this, but I think also because sort of this, we don't want to have a girl.
Mm-hmm.
Marriageable men and women in China are now going to outnumber each other by like 30 million.
What?
Like one in 20 men will not have a partner.
Oh.
So there's all these like dating services, not like a Tinder dating service, but like a literal dating coach for Chinese men on how to date. It's like professional pickup artists.
Yeah.
And it was actually like really kind of cute because the men were so nervous because dating's very different between China and America. Anyway.
Yeah.
So
sounds like a lady
long story short, long story short, China's had issues with women for a while. Anyway.
Oh, for millennia.
For a long time. Anyway, so there was a lot of death and poverty, and Chinese families valued boys over girls. And so many young girls were killed as a result. And now 100 years later, you have to pay a lot of like thousands of dollars for pickup artists so you can get married. So like, don't kill women.
Consequences.
Yeah. Don't kill your girl children. Okay. So I'm going to say.
Okay, thanks.
So Pearl would frequently sneak out of the house and join in funerals for the young girls when they were happening nearby.
Oh, wow.
And she would freak out the local Chinese because she was fluent in Chinese, but they had never seen a Western child speak it before. She would also sometimes find the bones of what she knew to be little girls lying in the grass, and she would bury them.
Oh, I love her already.
I know. So in an excerpt from Pearl Buck in China, which is a biography that Hilary Sperling wrote, she said, quote, "Where other little girls constructed mud pies, Pearl made miniature grave mounds, patting down the sides and decorating them with flowers or pebbles."
Oh, my word. That tells you something about who she's going to be when she grows up.
Right, exactly. But also, like, can you just imagine, like, being a little girl and then finding the bones of another little, like, I can't.
No.
The Seidenstricker's cook would read to Pearl and her siblings old Chinese novels like The White Snake, The Dream of the Red Chamber, and All Men Are Brothers. And this would later have a great impact on Pearl's own writing that featured narrative grip, strong plot lines, and stylized characterizations. Mm. So during the Boxer Uprising, many of their Chinese friends deserted them, and Western visitors to China decreased significantly. So Caroline and the kids went to Shanghai while their father stayed behind, convinced that, quote, no Chinese would wish him harm. Pearl was enrolled in Miss Jules' school in Shanghai, and it's not specified if this was an all-white or, like, an all-Western school, but we're kind of assuming that it is. Like, you went to a school, kind of, like, school for diplomats.
An American school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Pearl was dismayed by the racist attitudes of the other students, which is why we think probably wasn't a mixed school.
Mm-hmm.
Her parents had raised her to believe that Chinese people were their equals. Like they should.
Like you should.
Like a normal person.
Oh, you mean they're people just like me?
Right. In 1911, Pearl left China and attended Randolph-Macon Women's College in Lynchburg, Virginia. Mm-hmm. And she graduated Phi Beta Kappa in 1914.
Look at her.
She didn't intend to return to China, but her father wrote to her, since the Chinese didn't do harm to him, that her mother was ill. So Pearl applied for the Presbyterian Board and returned to China as a missionary in 1914. Her childhood in China obviously set her very apart from her classmates in college. Mm. She wrote later, quote, "Girls came in groups to stare at me." She wore out-of-date clothes made by a Chinese tailor and had experiences beyond most of these girls' imagination. I mean, including firsthand experience with war, sexual slavery, obviously finding bones of...
Literally burying the dead with her own hands.
So she marries an agricultural economist missionary named John Losing Buck on May 30th, 1917, and they moved to Suzhou in the Anhui province, and they lived there for a while. And then from 1920 to 1933, the other Bucks that lived in Nanjing were on the campus of the University of Nanking, where they both taught, and Pearl taught English literature. They had a daughter in 1920, but she had phenylketonuria, which is a disease that affects the metabolism. And then Pearl's mother dies in 1921, so her father moved in with them after. Now, skip forward a little bit, a couple of years, you know, living, teaching. In 1927, a battle broke out that Pearl referred to as the Nanking Incident, and it involved fighting between nationalist troops, communist forces, and just sort of assorted warlords. And during the battle, several Westerners were murdered, and Pearl's father still believed that no Chinese person would hurt them and insisted on that they stay in Nanking.
Mm-hmm.
However, when the fighting reached them, they were forced to hide in the house of a neighbor because their house was being looted. They were rescued by American gunboats and sailed to Japan, where they stayed for a year before returning to Nanking.
They went back.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, it's all, but like, it's also kind of her home when you think about it. Like, she only went to the States. She was born in the States, but then she only went back for college.
Yeah, that's fair.
And maybe she didn't intend to return, but now she's married there. Her daughter was born there. Like,
that's fair. It's her home.
You know, it's her home. So they did return, and then Pearl devotes herself to writing. She became very friendly with prominent Chinese writers, and they encourage her to think of herself as a professional writer. So between this time and 1929, Pearl also wanted to leave her husband, but she didn't have enough money to support her daughter, Carol. So she went back to the U.S. to find permanent care for her daughter. And while there, she met Richard J. Walsh, who was a publisher, and he accepted her first book, East Wind, West Wind. And they two began a relationship that resulted in marriage and many years of professional teamwork.
Yes.
In 1930, Pearl went to New York again with her still husband, John, and was invited to give an address at a luncheon of Presbyterian women. And her talk was titled, "Is There a Case for the Foreign Missionary?" And her answer was basically no. She argued that while she welcomed any Chinese person who shared her Christian faith, she didn't believe that China needed an institutional church dominated by missionaries who were often very ignorant of China. Of course, it was a pretty scandalous belief at the time, and so there was a lot of backlash. So Pearl resigned from the Presbyterian board in 1932.
Oh, okay.
Now in 1931, she published her book, The Good Earth, which became a massive success.
Okay.
So The Good Earth, did you have to read it in high school? No. Sometimes I feel it's on a high school reading list, and I read an excerpt from it. Also, my high school was weird, but I never read any full books. I only read excerpts of things.
That's strange. I went to 4 different high schools. Fair. So it's possible I missed it at one.
Well, I did correspondence high school because I was homeschooled. Fair. And the internet wasn't so great at the time. So I couldn't do like online school.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't mean to laugh at the fact that you were...
Right. Yeah. I mean, the internet as a whole, not like the reception at my house, but like the internet, like I don't think online school was a thing then. It was all through the mail.
Uh-huh.
And basically, this is total, just another side note, but basically the program that I did, we believe is really more geared towards people who are just trying to get their GED or a high school diploma rather quickly, whose English maybe not their first language. Because like if you find typos in your own high school textbook, probably not a great thing. But I mean, I have a high school diploma, so hey.
Heyo. But you seem to be doing very well for yourself.
Right. I think I did fine. I mean, I graduated summa cum laude or whatever, like 4.0 GPA. I think I did okay in the end. But anyway, yeah, our English courses just had excerpts from different books that you would read. So I also think it's part of the reason that I enjoy reading as much as I do is I've never looked at it as like, I have to read this book. It's assigned to me. Fair. Like I have to read the whole thing.
Yeah.
I would read 5 pages or something of this selected thing. So anyway, I've read some of The Good Earth, but I haven't read the whole thing because I didn't have to.
I know her name from school, but yeah, I don't think I read
that. Yeah, so in The Good Earth... This is kind of the description from Amazon. In The Good Earth, Pearl S. Buck paints an indelible portrait of China in the 1920s when the last emperor reigned and the vast political and social upheavals of the 20th century were but distant rumblings. This moving classic story of the honest farmer Wang Lung and his selfless wife O Lan is must reading for those who would fully appreciate the sweeping changes that have occurred in the lives of the Chinese people during the last century. Now, the main scene that most people remember and that I remember is the farmer cooking dirt. Like they're literally eating the earth because they have no food.
Mm-hmm.
And the book earned Pearl a Pulitzer Prize.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I bet if our listeners went to audibletrial.com/bitchery, they could get a free copy of that book.
Probably get it. Yeah. So she moves back to the U.S. permanently in 1933. In 1935, the Bucks were divorced and Pearl married Richard J. Walsh that very same day. So, you know, didn't waste any time.
the same day she got her divorce.
Right. So in 1938, Pearl was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature.
Heyo, 2 weeks, first, 3 Nobel Prizes.
Right, the first time it was ever awarded to an American woman.
Oh, wow.
When awarding the prize, the Nobel Prize Committee said, quote, "By awarding this year's prize to Pearl Buck for the notable works which pave the way to a human sympathy passing over widely separated racial boundaries and for the studies of human ideals, which are a great and living art of portraiture, the Swedish Academy feels that it acts in harmony and accord with the aim of Alfred Nobel's dreams for the future."
Yes. I love it.
In her speech to the Academy, she explained, quote, "I am an American by birth and by ancestry, but my earliest knowledge of story, of how to tell and write stories, came to me in China."
Hmm.
She concluded the speech by saying that in China, quote, "The novelist did not have the task of creating art, but of speaking to the people. I have been taught to want to write for these people. If they are reading their magazines by the millions, then I want my stories there rather than in magazines read only by a few."
Yes.
End quote. out.
Yes.
So in 1949, Pearl Buck started the adoption agency Welcome House, which specialized in the adoption of Asian American children. Huh. And in 1964, she established the Pearl S. Buck Foundation to further address issues of poverty and discrimination faced by children in Asian countries, which is no surprise if you're freaking 5 years old and burying your neighbors in your backyard.
Literally.
Oh, my God. So during China's Cultural Revolution in the late 60s and 70s, Buck's writings were not revered by the Chinese government, obviously.
Surprise, surprise.
Right. So Chinese novelist An Chi Min remembers that in 1971, quote, "I was a teen and I was going to school at the Shanghai Middle School and I was asked to denounce Pearl Buck as an American cultural imperialist," end quote.
Oh.
The Cultural Revolution placed an emphasis on denouncing all things American at the time.
Sure.
And Buck was effectively barred from re-entering the country during this time.
Hmm.
Which is fair. She was very anti-communist, which spurred the ban on her works in China. She attacked internal communist repression in The Three Daughters of Madame Liang, which told the truth of the Cultural Revolution while many people in the West turned a blind eye. She also denounced the Chinese invasion of Tibet in her novel Mandela. And in a story called The Commander and the Commissar. In 1972, President Nixon had planned to visit China and invited Buck to come with him.
Whoa.
Now, Madam Mao started a campaign to reject Pearl Buck. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, Pearl was then not able to return to China before her death. During the 70s, she positioned to re-enter the country, writing to Chinese leaders and members of the White House. But in May of 1972, a Chinese bureaucrat who was stationed in Canada sent her a letter that says, quote, "You have in your works taken an attitude of distortion, smear, and vilification towards the people of New China and its leaders, and I am authorized to inform you that we cannot accept your request for a visit to China." And then she died in 1973. Dang. From lung cancer. And gradually, she's become more and more acceptable in China and treated with sort of diminishing official hostility by the government. Her childhood home in Zhenjiang was restored and opened to the public. And in May of 2012, the faculty of Nanjing University gained approval and raised funds for the restoration of the campus house where Buck had lived. And the reopening of the house was actually marked by an international conference.
Wow.
And what really made and makes Pearl Buck's writing stand out was her focus on rural life in China in the 20th century. Because no one, not even Chinese writers, were writing about the lives of farming families.
Oh.
So in this way, Pearl sort of preserved and showcased an aspect of Chinese life that might otherwise have been totally lost or never discussed.
That's amazing.
And that is Pearl Buck.
How amazing is that?
So cool.
I love that. Well, first of all, I think it really was, again, I'll say it again, it says something about a person when they're a child.
Yeah.
Not only do they see, I mean, I know lots of kids, and I feel like me as a kid, if I had seen someone's bones, my first thought would not have been, I should properly bear that. It would be, let me run as far away as I can.
Yes, it would be, we are haunted. There are ghosts.
Exactly.
I am done.
And her thought was, I should pay proper respects to this. That says something about a person. That's amazing.
Yeah, she is so cool.
Hey friends, if you have enjoyed season 3 of The Bitchery of History as much as we have enjoyed making it, do us a favor and look down at that iPod, iPhone, Android device, Samsung Galaxy, your note phone, whatever kind of phone you've got, or computer, or Zoom that you're listening to, and give this podcast a rating or a review. Those ratings and reviews, they help other people find this podcast, which helps us keep doing this podcast. See you next season.
Hey, everyone. If you have liked season 3, season 2, season 1 of Bitchery of History, and you cannot wait and are super excited for season 4, do you want to get involved and help make all of these shows happen? You can do that by going to patreon.com and searching The Bitchery of History, or even just downloading the Patreon app. It's super simple. $1 a podcast, $10 a month. You set the level you want to donate at, and we will use your money to create amazing content.
As we finish this last episode of the season, why don't we take a little trip down memory lane?
Sure.
And talk about some of the amazing and astounding women that we have talked about this season so far.
Absolutely. And all of the cool things that we did. I mean, cool, maybe isn't the right word, but being able to go down to the Me Too March with you and Jeanette. I know you guys all got to go and participate in March for Our Lives.
Yes, that was amazing.
I mean, I made Banging Lainey. Like, outside of the podcast, we did so much. And there seems to be such a new sort of feminist movement growing.
Agreed.
And
is,
I'm excited to be a part of it.
It is exciting to see the movements that are happening now, especially not to get political, but since the last election, we're seeing this resurgence of a women's movement.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we had talked about when we first started this podcast was we want to make sure that these stories are heard by absolutely everybody. And at first it was difficult getting people to like pay attention or be like, well, why are you making this? Or why are you doing this?
Right.
And now it's like everyone just sees it.
Yeah.
And I walk up to someone and I'm like, oh, I have this podcast. First of all, do you want a sticker? And second of all, it's like I tell people that, we'll have covered by the end of the season 174 women.
It's amazing.
And they're like, oh, I've been looking for more stories. Where do I find it?
Yeah.
And that's so gratifying a lot of the time.
Absolutely.
So who are some of your favorite women that we've done?
I think Agnetus was a huge surprise to me as a story and as a woman, something I'd never heard before.
Hmm.
And I read a lot of history.
Yeah.
I'm kind of surprised by that one.
I think one of my favorite people that we did, not maybe one of my least favorite people that we did, was Phyllis Schlafly.
Yeah.
And knowing her story and being able to kind of see the impact that she had.
Yeah.
Because it's so important to like know thy enemy. Right?
Right.
Like know
right.
what's happening so that you can fight it.
Absolutely.
And on the other hand, Gloria Steinem.
Right.
To know that there was this like titanic battle happening during that time.
Absolutely.
The Virgin Mary. Right.
Virgin Mary was
our Christmas
great.
Special.
Delving into that. Pauli Murray was
amazing. Yes. We did Lady Bits.
Yep. So many.
Talking about Joan of Arc, the many faces of Joan of Arc, and talking about ties between The Handmaid's Tale and Phyllis Schlafly. That was amazing as well.
Sorry, Phyllis Schlafly makes me want to vomit.
Stop talking about her.
No, it's fine. No, but you're totally right. And I think what's important about that and about, you know, when we cover women like Belle Gunness and Griselda Blanco is not only remembering that women are not perfect and don't put us on a pedestal. It's just another excuse not to look us in the
eye. Yes, that's my favorite quote.
I know, it's amazing. Is that women can also have varying opinions of what is right for women or what is good for them or what have you. And I think that that's important to remember because it humanizes the other side of the conversation and having at least being able to have that understanding and then just say, hey, I understand where you're coming from.
Right.
1000% disagree. But I get it. And I think that that's valuable.
Yeah, because that's where compromise comes from.
Right.
That allows you to grow. And I think, you know, another example of that was Gudu Mai.
Yeah.
And talking about the kind of shady past that she had, but then being able to have Sydney come on and say Gudu Mai has been a very uplifting and an influential and a growing force in my life. Or at least if not Gudu Mai herself, then the practice that she started and the things that she's putting out
in the world.
Of course.
And I loved doing all our interviews. That's been a blast.
Yes, that is going to keep going. And in fact, we should say, we haven't said that yet, but if you're sad that season three is ending, Bitchery is actually not going to fully go away in between the seasons. We're going to keep doing Bitch Next Door throughout the break and throughout the summer.
Because we want to interview so many people.
Exactly. Exactly. So when we say if you have suggestions for people for us to interview,
send them our way.
Send them to us, please, either on Facebook or at umpboh.com. All those different places. We've actually already started getting a couple of suggestions of women to do for season four of places we can go.
Love it.
And maybe that's what we should talk about now, kind of the things that we're thinking about doing in the meantime, going and doing more filmed content.
Yeah, we'd love, I know that we would both love to do another live show if we can organize that and make that happen. I know that some podcasts like go on tour around the country. Like
they
how do we do that?
I want to get a bus.
Okay.
We buy like a cheap bus.
Well, like, can I have a bathroom?
We'll buy a cheap coach bus.
Perfect.
With AC and an auxiliary cord.
And a bathroom.
And a bathroom. That's why it's coach bus, not a school bus.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Sweet.
I love
think
it. What I loved most about this season, you know, this season we focused a lot more on modern women.
Yeah.
As opposed to previous seasons where it's been a lot of more ancient women or a lot of women pre-1900s, pre-1800s. Yeah. And I think what that's helped us kind of to do and kind of to see is that, you know, throughout history, the movement of women has not only been singular and focused on specific places, yeah. but, you know, history is made by those who show up. Decisions are made by those who show up. And people have been showing up everywhere, always. And you just have to pay attention.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that was actually, if we weren't going to be talking about this, I was going to talk about, there's a new documentary out on Netflix called Mercury 13.
Okay.
And it's about the sort of secret side project of Dr. Lovelace, who was the doctor who studied all the astronauts and was saying, like, you're fit to go to space, you're not, gave them all this testing. And he decided that he also wanted to test women and see how they held up. And he thought that they probably would do a better job.
Right.
And then when NASA found out, they were all upset and, like, kicked them out, basically, of the program.
Great.
It's a pretty good documentary. It could be better, which kind of bums me out because, I don't know, I just feel like, stop giving people the short end of the stick.
Yeah.
But all of that to say, I think that there are so many books written about John Glenn and Scott Carpenter and Neil Armstrong and all the Apollo astronauts and NASA in general and all these things. And it's like, if you just look a little deeper,
just a little deeper,
just like a little deeper, it's not even a secret anymore. But if you just dig a little deeper, it's like, where were the women? And you find, oh, the women were there.
They were there.
A
woman wrote the code that allowed the lander to land on the moon.
Yeah. And they made it happen. Yeah. And yeah, also, by the way, a lot of times they did better than the men on the tests.
And it would have been cheaper to send the women to the moon.
Totally. Especially in the sensory deprivation chamber that they had to do.
Uh-huh.
Apparently women were like way better at it, which I just find hilarious because one of these women, they also were not supposed to have kids to apply, the women.
Okay.
I think the men, it didn't matter. But one of them basically lied. She had like 6 kids and she was just chilling. And I'm like, well, duh, you have 6 kids and someone is like, hey, for as long as you can lay here quietly,
right,
we're not going to disturb you. Like, I would stay for days. I would never get out.
Can I take one of these home? Is there a commercial version of these?
Right. Absolutely.
You want me to get into a bathtub in the dark by myself?
Yeah. And just chill.
Someone else is going to watch my kids? Oh, wait. No.
Fine.
Wait, no, my kids. Fine. I don't have kids.
So there's just things like that, that, you know, there's such significant events in history.
Exactly.
And as we've gone looking into, it's just going, oh, where were the women?
It's almost as if, you know, the musical Wicked.
Yeah.
One of my favorite explanations for Wicked that I've ever heard is it's as if someone took the cameras from The Wizard of Oz and just panned to the right just a little bit. Like the story of Wicked happened. It happened when it happened.
Right.
Just no one saw it while it was happening.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's almost what we're doing. Like we're just taking the camera that's pointed at the man and going, why don't you just pan a little bit? And it turns out there's a woman waving to the camera as well, just slightly off screen.
Right.
I agree.
Hedy Lamarr is really starting
to
come to the forefront.
There's a new documentary.
New documentary. And I was hearing the description of the documentary as Hedy Lamarr is basically the actual female version of Forrest Gump.
I heard that too. Were you listening to NPR?
Yes. Yeah. Of course I was listening to NPR.
So was I.
Which I love.
Yeah.
I mean, there are so many women who are just involved in massive moments and massive decisions, and
absolutely,
they just don't tend to be as recognized.
And, you know, even along those same lines, I think one of my favorite episodes we did this season was our fictional episode, the mythological episode.
Yes.
And I think that's equally as important to say
absolutely
that women as literary figures or women as figures of import that are fictional is just as important as well, because do we not look up to fictional characters just as much? I mean,
I'm so ready for Captain Marvel.
Yeah.
And also Wonder Woman.
I mean,
every day.
I mean, Wonder Woman, Captain Marvel, Hermione Granger, Luna Lovegood, like all of the Harry Potter women, Eowyn,
Daenerys,
all
of the
like
people.
Khaleesi, like these are women that we also look up to and who enter into the zeitgeist and serve as inspiration for women just as much as any woman who lived and did amazing things in real life.
Which I think I want to end on my favorite thing from this year, the past year-ish, which is the meme of Carrie Fisher and Robin Wright that says, I have lived long enough to see my princesses turn into generals.
Amen.
And on that note, if you miss us in the meantime, we are still here. Do not panic. You can find us on all the social media. Just search The Bitchery of History on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram.
You know, people get surprised when I respond personally to messages on Facebook, but it's not like I will respond.
Yeah.
Jeanette will respond. You will get a personal response from one of us if you message us. You can also find us on our website. That's UMPBOH, Ursula Major Productions, Bitchery of History, UMPBOH.com. See pictures of us, see pictures of the women, contact us there as well.
Allison. Goodbye for season 3, but we'll be back.
Yes, we will, absolutely.
With the team, you know them, Jeanette,
Kim,
Sydney,
and Jess.
And remember,
bitches get stuff done.